Hello, Rakesh. Welcome to the LoVoShow podcast. How are you?
Good, thanks. And you?
Feeling great. I'm so happy to have you on the show. Today is going to be a first of its kind episode because we will be talking about your experience with OSHO. You spent many years in the OSHO commune, but also we will be talking about how your spiritual journey progressed after OSHO left the body, meaning that you came across a new master. So that's going to be fascinating to hear. But let's start from the beginning. So tell us a little bit about how you came to know about OSHO.
Well, I always wanted to have a master. I don't know where that really came from, but suddenly it was there and it was strong. And I tried to go to India overland when I was 19 and I didn't make it. And then when I was 23, I went again, and this time I flew straight into Bombay, checked into a traveler's hotel I was told to go to, and there were sannyasins there in that hotel on their way to Mount Abu for a camp. And they said, hey, we have this master right here in Bombay, there's an apartment. And I'm like, there's no way that I would ever have a master. So I had this really romantic idea of in a cave in the Himalayas or in a jungle in South, something like that, not an apartment. So I didn't go. So I missed my first opportunity, and which happens to me a lot. I'm kind of slow in that way. But for 6 months, then I traveled around India, just trying to not go on a conventional path, just kind of get off a bus when I felt like it and ask for the nearest ashram. There's ashrams everywhere. So you can kind of, and with no real, somehow I knew what I was looking for without really in my mind knowing. So nothing was it. That was clear. And then I got, after 6 months, back to Goa, and I saw some sannyasins there. And then I thought, wow, maybe I should go to Bombay and check this guy out. And then that was the next thing. That's what I did. At that time, you had to do dynamic for 3 days on the beach and then take all your smells off. Smell free, come with fresh clothing, and you got to go in Osho's bedroom. And that was, and everybody was saying, wow, he's going to put the mala on you and you're going to, and, you know. So I was prepared for that whole thing. I was prepared to be wowed, and none of that happened either. It seemed like, you know, he was a beautiful looking man, but the questions in our conversation seemed very much like many I'd had already, you know, what is the purpose of your visit here? And have you ever meditated? Just kind of very simple questions. And then it was over. And then I was with a friend and we left, and I was kind of disappointed in my mind. Wow, that didn't live up to, he didn't give me the mala, he didn't give me sannyas, none of that happened. I was kind of, and I think it's a very interesting point that it's really not your mind that really registers the, what's going on. And that's been a theme of mine then and ever since then. And my friend and I sat down in the waiting room in his apartment, in the corridor, there was a couple of chairs. And my friend said that I seemed to go to sleep for about half an hour, and he just stared at the shoe rack. And then we just got up and left. And then we just started walking through Bombay, and I said after about half an hour again, where are we going? And my friend said, I don't know, I was following you. So we were like actually zonked, actually right blasted. But it was happening on a sort of a more subtle level or than we were ready for. It all was happening in a deeper, more subtle, more... But from then on, that was kind of, we were just, for days, we were kind of in this heightened stage. We couldn't sleep. We were just buzzed. That was the first meeting.
Okay, so I understand now what you mean with the slow start. Definitely, it's very different experience from many of the other people I interviewed, where the minute they sit in front of Osho, that was it. So then tell us, how did you take sannyas? One, maybe the second or third meeting? So how did that happen?
So we during that first meeting, he said, when Osho said, where are you going? We said, oh, we're going to this Kumbh Mela next, this huge celebration with millions of people. It happens every number of years. It's the biggest spiritual something that happens in India. Then we're going trekking in Nepal, and then we're going overland back to Europe. And he kind of casually said, yeah, well, come and see me before you go back to Europe. And we said, yeah, okay, sure. Sort of not, you know, we weren't thinking straight, because it's like 1,000 miles out of the way. You know, when you're up in Nepal already, to come all the way down to Bombay. But we said, sure. And then we went to this Kumbh Mela, and we met lots of gurus and sadhus, like millions of them. And it just, every day, became more clear that what we had met in Bombay was real, and what we were seeing at this was kind of, didn't reach those same heights at all. So we were getting more and more convinced that it was. And then we went to Nepal, and we were trekking, and I woke up one morning and I just said to my friend, I'm going back to Bombay. And I just turned around, I'm going to take sannyas. And he kept going to the end of the trek, and then he took a small plane back, and he got back to Kathmandu the same time I did. And then we both continued on to Bombay, but he had moved. Meanwhile, he'd moved to Pune, so we went to Pune. So in our second meeting, we took sannyas, and we still hadn't even heard like a discourse. We hadn't seen him talking to other people, talking to a crowd. So that was our second meeting, and that was it, really.
Yes, and then I understand that you spent many, many years living in the commune, and that not only changed you in terms of your spiritual growth, but also in terms of your profession, because by living in the commune, you found your call in life.
That's right, yes.
So tell us a little bit about that. How did that happen, and what is your profession?
Well, I do deep body work. I learned Rolfing at that time, and I learned it in the ashram, on chosen by Osho from a list of people. And that was my way. I had no profession before that, really. So I really wanted to live in the ashram. That was like my number one. I wanted to be as close as possible. I didn't really have any profession. And then suddenly this Rolfing idea came, because Osho was saying that he really thought Rolfing was a good thing for Westerners to go through, because they were too fidgety. They couldn't sit still. So this Rolfing, this deep structural work, would really help them to relax and become more open. So it was along with the therapies that were just starting up at that time. Encounter was just starting in Primal. It was in that same vein. There was one Rolfer there. He was already very busy. Osho told him to train more people. I was one of the two people that got trained. And then a few years later, all the different body works that were going on there kind of came together, and what that became Osho Rebalancing. And then I started working with that and later got to teach that as well. So that just became my path and my way to stay in India, my way to travel around the world, my way to this day. And I'm still doing sessions now and teaching a little bit. And it's been amazing. It's a gift. And I think that in Indian masters, they do, or masters in general, they help on every level. So it's not just on the spiritual, which is what I thought initially, but they really help you everywhere. And that's what, this was part of that help that I received then.
Fascinating to hear that you feel this way, that Osho helped you not just on a spiritual level, but also professionally finding your way. Have you ever had a chance to speak to Osho? Because you mentioned that he chose you. He said that you were one of those chosen to receive the training. Did you ask him why he chose you, or did you have any conversation, or you just went with the flow? And
no, I was overjoyed just to go with the flow. And then maybe a year later, I went to Darshan one night and I was talking, you know, with something, I don't remember what I was saying actually, but I was talking about my work, about the Rolfing, and I kept saying, and when I'm working this or that, and he kind of like just stopped me and he said, it is not your work, it is your love. And it was just like, that just cut through all of whatever it was that I had at the time that I was trying to present. So that was, I think, my deepest teaching in terms of what this really was, you know, that it and that's what, why rebalancing, I think, was born, because it was, there was the body work aspect, different kinds of body work, Alexander method, Feldenkrais, Rolfing, postural integration, everything was coming together. And then with a meditative, because all the trainings had a lot of meditation, and of course it was a meditation. So that, and love, that love was really, if you worked in love, then what you did was, you just, whatever you did was secondary. And what was really primary was that you were in this field of love, you were like, healing could happen. The person was healing themselves in this field, and the field was the field of love. So that was, you know, first you're like really enamored with the technique, you're learning this technique and you're all excited, and but eventually it becomes less and less, you need the techniques, the techniques are a good foundation, but this other thing that's going through it is really where it's happening.
Very, very beautiful. So it sounds to me from what you're saying that rebalancing was born in Pune by coming together of different massage therapists different techniques. And it's a good example of what Pune represented at the time. It was like a laboratory for evolution of consciousness. It was a place for experimentation, creativity, finding new ways to help people realize their human potential and go deeper in meditation and personal growth.
Exactly. And what it was like, a all the different types of body work were there. After a few years, they were all there. But nobody was competing, saying this, ours is better, because we all had enough people coming for us that we didn't have to get the people. They all booked. You know, we had nothing to do. We didn't get the money. We didn't have to. It was nothing. It was just doing those sessions. So there was no competition with the other. And we got to exchange sessions. So you could sign up to get a session every week with another therapist. So in that atmosphere, I was suddenly doing Feldenkrais moves in my Rolfing sessions. And the and the Alexander teacher was doing deep strokes. So it was getting so mixed together that we had to find something, another umbrella to put it under, and that was rebalancing. It was beautiful to have that.
Absolutely. It sounds like a perfect scenario where, you know, all the specialists have a continuous flow of people. There is no competition and there is no money involved. It's just pure creativity, pure love, pure experimentation. So I'm wondering, is there anything like this today in the world where, you know, we can compare to Pune and at that time where you have this flow of creativity and energy in creating something new?
I think there must be pockets of that. And I think there's different people that were the teachers then, for example, just in rebalancing, that are teaching now, or their students are teaching. So there are small pockets everywhere. It's a different scenario. That was just like a huge... Osho was really able to create something big on the outside, huge. And I don't know if there's anything like that, even close to that. But now it just seems to have been spread out. It's on more different levels. It's on more different, in different areas. You can't compare it, and yet it's not, I wouldn't say it's less, it just looks really different. So that energy is moving.
Okay, now that's good to hear. On the other hand, what I see today, that the self-development industry, it's quite big. It's grown on the back of the human potential movement and Osho and all the sannyasins. But today, what seems prevalent is mindful kind of approaches, mindful therapy. And it seems a little bit ironic because it's an approach that is rooted in a very ancient tradition, the Buddhist tradition, whereas Osho is a modern Buddha, and he made a huge effort to create all these more modern methods that are much more useful for modern people. So where do you see the innovation and the legacy of Osho's and the human potential movement as well, together with the Osho input and the meditation and therapy and the massage and all of that? What's the legacy today?
You know, if you think about, like, because you mentioned Buddhism or Buddha, it's like he had his teaching that he gave to everyone, and beautiful teachings and beautiful techniques, the mindfulness, let's say, also. And he had more like the teaching that he did in silence, you know, when he was like holding up the flower, and that was like... Or Jesus, you know, he only got to teach for a few years, so he had to come back after he was resurrected. And he had more like the deeper teachings that he gave. And I think it's like that now also, is that there's the more surface levels, like the mindfulness, that's very helpful in terms of healing emotional problems, mental problems. And then there's also the Osho meditations that are more active and really helpful in setting the stage, and so that people can learn about relaxation or learn the fundamentals, let's say. And then there's the deeper teaching, which Osho also said is in silence and is between the words. And I think that teaching doesn't really hinge on whether Osho is alive or not, or in the body or not. That silent teaching, if you can attune to it, keeps going. It's timeless. It's beyond, it's outside of time. So I think the legacy is way more subtle now. But you start with the fundamentals, you enter, and then this whole other world opens up, which is much more, you know, it's like, goes back to that same thing when I said I met Osho in that room, and the words that were happening were like not even the tip of the iceberg. It was like almost nothing. And the rest of it was all happening on a deeper level. And that's where he was pointing me. And he's always been pointing to that deeper level. Not that many times I haven't gotten distracted and caught in the new and up, you know, what's new right now, what therapies, what's going on, what's this, what's that. So many years I was distracted, which is okay. It's part of it, the distraction. But then the going deeper into the silence, into the stillness, into the simplicity, that also I think takes time. That's kind of, you need a whole lifetime or maybe numerous lifetimes.
Yes, indeed. It does take time, at least for me personally. I can see that it's not that easy. For me, for example, that I chose, or I don't know if I chose it, but it just happened to me that I feel like Osho is my master and I want to be with Osho. But Osho is no more physically present. There is no more puna. There is no more that kind of boost of energy that was so powerful. And of course, I'm not saying that, you know, I never had access to that energy in some form or shapes, but no one can deny that being with an alive master, with hundreds or thousands of people meditating together in a Buddha field, that's more powerful. I mean, there's no doubt about that. So, yeah, and I feel like sometimes it's...
It's very powerful, just to interrupt for a second. It is really powerful, and it's wonderful, and it's helpful. And it's also distracting as well, because you're kind of carried along, you know, like, wow, I'm an amazing meditator, because the field is like just taking you, or he's taking you. And then you're on your own, and you found out, wow, I can't sit still for 5 minutes. So it's helpful to learn, but it's also can be, you know, those early days of Pune were so exciting and so filled with constant distraction, which is when you're young, you know, you want to be distracted. Also, it's part of, you know, there's really no way of, and I think another point I wanted to actually address that you said, you know, Osho is your master. I think it's really what I've realized is that I thought I'm choosing Osho. And now I thought, okay, I'm choosing John, but you're not. It's they're choosing you. You're being called and you either respond to that call. So you have choice. Not that it's choices, but you're called and then you do it or you don't. And how deeply you do it, it's also up to you. But you're always being called and it's always one step deeper, one step deeper, one step deeper, one step more honest, one step more simple. You know, it's all, they're ahead of you on the path. But you didn't choose Osho, but you got him.
Wow, that is so useful to hear from me, both points you made, because it's something that is true. I see, otherwise it would be so easy, you know, for all the thousands of people who were there with Osho and Puna and they were flying so high, you know, they would be enlightened by now. But if it was that easy, but actually, you know,
that's
sometimes...
Right.
Being on your own is where you really grow, because no one can give you enlightenment from outside of yourself, even an enlightened master or a Buddha field. So that's beautiful. And the other point of Osho choosing me, yeah, that's how I feel sometimes, yes. So on this note, I think it's perfect timing to shift the conversation and talk a little bit about how you moved from one master to another. And it's the first time that I address this in an interview on this Love Osho podcast. And it's just really, I'm genuinely interested to hear your internal process. How did that happen? Not just the external circumstances of you going somewhere and meeting. Like, what happened inside of you? What was the process? You know, because obviously the questions that come to mind, you know, don't you feel maybe a conflict inside? Did you feel like you were betraying Osho? You know, these kind of questions that sometimes I ask myself and think, you know, maybe one day I'll meet another master, but I don't know, I'm with Osho. You know, like, I'd love to hear your story on that.
Yeah, it was... So basically, the day that Osho left his body, it was like, I was devastated. I was there, and, you know, he had been saying that it's like such an opportunity. And I'd read in the books, you know, like Gurdjieff, such an opportunity when the master dies, everyone's kind of like lifted up, sucked up by the energy of him leaving. And I didn't feel any of that. I felt terrible. And he said, I won't go until you're ready. And all my mind was just like, I'm not ready. I'm not ready. I'm not ready. So that was like people were going up to Lucknow then to be with Papaji. And I'm like, no, I'm not going. I'm with Osho. I'm loyal. I stayed another like 9 years really in going every year to Pune for some months. And I was very loyal. So there was two things going on, the loyalty part and the commitment part, and then this other part where, wow, I'm not ready to be on my own. And I don't know. So those were just two streams that were happening. And at that time in 99, I had so 9 years after Osho had left, I had a girlfriend who was a sannyasin but had never met Osho. And she was like looking for a living master. I would go with her, we'd go to Bombay to see this person and up into the Himalayas to see that person. And I was like, kind of, oh, ho-hum. You know, it's none of it touches me in that way. I was like further proof that it was just going to be Osho all the way. But I was hoping that she would find a living master. So I was really supportive. And then... And then she did. She found this man, John de Ruyter, from Canada, which is where I'm from, and in Western Canada, like in the prairies. And I wasn't there when she met him. And she told me, yeah, I've met this amazing guy from Canada. I'm like, yeah, yeah. How can a guru be a Westerner? And how can he be from Canada? You know, all of that. And then it was like meeting Osho in that way, that something happened that was so, I was taken. I didn't really, my mind took a couple of months to catch up. And I still kept thinking it was something for her and not me. And I was going to go back to India. And then one day, this man, John, we met. I was just leaving, actually, and he was also going somewhere. We met at the airport, and he said, well, where are you from? And I said, well, actually, I'm Canadian. And he said, oh, then it will be really easy for you to move here. And I hear myself saying, yeah, it's going to be really easy. And it was like, that was the first I knew of it, that I'd already been somehow taken. And for me, that's how it seems to work. It's kind of my mind catches up. And then within a couple of months, I'd packed up in India and I was living in the prairie where I am now. So that's the story.
Cool. So is this master still alive and are you still with him?
Yeah, very much. He's very much alive and I'm very much with him. And at the moment, because of COVID, we're together and on Zoom, just like we are now, but it's the whole group. And so we have meetings on Zoom, which is because of the years that I spent person to person, you know, it seems fine on Zoom. It doesn't seem any different, the powerfulness, the quality. And the more that I've learned, the more that I know that it's mysterious, that it's the whole process, as I always imagined it and romanticized it and kind of put it into whatever package I put it into. It's not like that. It's really, in a way, much more than that. That's like the more you can step out of your own way and the more you can step out of any preconceptions, the more amazing it is. It's an amazing journey. It just keeps going, no matter what. It just keeps going, and it's really a matter of letting go of what you think that you know. It's always being in the new. That's what I'm learning the most now. It's like how to not have anything that I learned yesterday get in the way of what's happening now.
Okay, so now I've got a stupid question. So forgive me for that, because
right.
The answer is in a different level, but I feel compelled to ask, you know, because when I look at Osho, you know, Osho is so deep, so vast. He's not just a mystic and an enlightened master, but he's such a genius. You know, he's like when he talks, and the way he articulates argument, his knowledge, his brilliancy, his beauty. I mean, it's just so all around beauty. And then for me, like when I look at other masters, I don't know, I can't help compare. So have you ever felt any conflict or comparison between Osho and a new master?
In the beginning, a lot, you know, and I kind of felt like, looking back on it, that I kind of swaggered in and like, wow, I was with Osho all these years and you guys are like these kind of hicks from Canada. And I had a lot of that in the beginning. So I really felt like my storehouse of knowledge given by Osho, that I had access to that. And then a lot of the process, I have to say, in the beginning, the first years was kind of being stripped away of all of that, in the same way that Osho had stripped away what I thought I knew before. Now with John, he was stripping away what I thought I had learned. And it gets less and less and less and less and less. It's like, you know, like you're cooking onions and you're just kind of like getting it down to almost nothing. But that what's left over is the real. Once you get rid of all of that. So yes, there was a lot of conflict and in the beginning and comparison. And plus, in some ways, I thought I knew more than this master. And I was definitely rudely awakened out of that over time. And it's been a pleasure. It's just like getting lighter and lighter. You know, as I get older, instead of being weighed down by my past, I just see more and more the value of all of it, you know, including all of the mistakes, or especially all of the mistakes and all of the misunderstanding. And you should check him out, this guy too, because he's a Western teacher talking to Western people. And Osho had to learn, you know, when we would go in the early days and sit for a month listening to the Hindi discourses, they were amazing, even though we didn't understand any of the words. The energy of it was fabulous. And that, and his command of that, his native language was, even though he came really in English, he became superlative. You could tell he was on a higher level in Hindi. He was like, the audience was just like one person. It would just go up and down and laugh and cry, everybody, because he had such a command. And with John, it's like that in English. He has the command of the language, and there's a lot of silence in his time with people. A lot of it is silent, so there's a lot of time. Yeah.
Wonderful. Look, I really appreciate your honesty, your opening up and telling things how they are, and that's wonderful to hear. So we are heading towards the end. Is there anything else you would like to add before I ask you two final questions?
All the thing that pops into my mind is that is if one is called to as fully as possible answer that call, whatever it may be. And you know, I've heard Osho say too that even if you're with a false master, if you're true, then you're going to benefit. And you know, what I'm learning now with John is about purity of heart. That might be the highest value, to have a clean, to be clean in your heart, to not bring too much not bring any personality or your small self into your heart. Have your heart be as clean as possible, and then everything is possible from there. That's kind of like the key that I'm learning at the moment.
Wow, that's actually a very beautiful key.
Yes, it is.
Beautiful learning. Okay, so I've got two final questions, going back a little bit to Osho. What is, in your view, Osho's greatest contribution to the world?
You know, I can't really imagine the world without Osho, or with Osho, how it would be different. It was somehow he seemed to be at a critical moment in history. He was there when a great deal of Western people were looking for something and were ready to, you know, it was, my parents were refugees and they didn't have that same ability to, because they were really busy. They were busy in their lives with security, with money, with all of that. And that gave me the opportunity to go beyond that and not have that concern. And that was what it was like in that time. A lot of people had that opportunity, and he was there, and he was big in that way. He was really big, that he could embrace the whole planet, you know, and he really, and he took on fearlessly, he took on everybody. And so he just kind of got the ball rolling. I think he really helped to get the ball rolling, and now it seems to be rolling, and it's a race, you know, because humanity is also rolling in not so good directions at a faster pace, which is also an opportunity. It's all really an opportunity to wake up the present state of the planet. And it was like Osho was planting seeds. I think he was really planting seeds then, a lot of which we didn't appreciate. Like, why is he talking about this? And why is he talking about Indian society the way it could be? And now you see Indian society has really moved forward in a lot of areas that he was addressing way back then, you know, in the 70s. So yeah, he was a master for the age and for different levels of awakening.
Well, that's amazing to have this historical context and background to think of Osho in these terms, because it's absolutely true, you know, makes sense, beautiful. So the last question is, what is the most beautiful gift you received from Osho?
Well, I can't put my finger on one. I've already talked about my work and the whole, what he did for that, and my, if I was a little speck of something and he made me into a snowball and he got that snowball rolling down the hill so it could keep moving and picking up speed. So eternal gratefulness for that on so many levels. And basically I'm very kind of laid back, kind of lazy-ish person on my own, And he put me into so many situations where I had to stretch energetically, physically, mentally, beyond my capacity. That was the commune. And that was, now I know, you know, I didn't know before that I was capable of doing all that we did, that I could do all that myself. And now I do, and that comes in handy. So he's just energetically, he's helped mentally, physically, emotionally, the whole package.
Well, thank you so much. And on this note of gratefulness, eternal gratefulness, a beautiful way to end this conversation. I really enjoyed talking to you. I've learned a lot. I got some really good insight. So yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for sharing, opening your heart and speaking up your mind and participating into the Lobosho podcast.
Yes, very welcome. Thanks for going into a different, newer path for you guys of having somebody that has another teacher. Because that's something Osho said, that some of you will just stay with me, and some of you will go somewhere else and do something else. And he was big enough to hold that. So it's nice that your podcast is also big enough to embrace that. So thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you so much. Lots of love and a big hug. Bye.
To you too. Bye-bye.